This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. If you're a fan of MPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
John Walden,
Iola Hegarty,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, John, you've had over 25 years with a big interest in public health.
Yes, I have. When I started working at Massey University, one of the first projects we had going at the time was to run the Public Health Association conference here in Palmerston North. So I got dragged into it and I really enjoyed it and met a whole lot of like-minded people, including Pat Nutter, who I'd met many, many years ago, and George Salmon came along. So we had a very successful conference and we ran another one here in Palmerston North in 2000.
So what sort of people were involved in the Public Health Association?
People from a wide variety of backgrounds. One of the movers and shakers was Bob McKeag. He is a periodontist. His dad used to be, the McKeags were from here. From
periodontist.
Which
does
gums.
Dentist.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, he's a dentist, sorry.
Oh, sort of around the teeth rather than the teeth themselves.
Gum disease. He was lovely. Bob became president at that meeting, and it might have been the year later in Dunedin. Anyway, he encouraged me to join the PHA, and then he tried to lure me away from Massey by asking me if I wanted to do medicine, but that's another story.
So it was largely sort of practitioner-based or social policy issue people who attend that, or was it an academic-type conference?
There were academics there. There were people from the public health centres at Otago University, both Wellington and Dunedin. There was the beginnings of one at Massey University. The people from Auckland came down. Academically, it was based around the public health training program for public health medicine specialists, but also included in that were the workers working in the public health units that are funded out of the Ministry of Health, but are located in various hospitals.
Okay,
and they are the people that do the contact tracing today.
The COVID.
COVID-19
contact tracing.
Prior to that, they're involved in like the measles contact tracing. We can go into that on another day. Also involved in public health were local body people that were involved in compliance. From the other NGOs, people who were health promotion practitioners, like from the Cancer Society, the Drug Foundation, and quite a few Māori providers are interested in public health.
Work type people?
We didn't have many people from the social services.
Sort of stopping violence type people. There were several conference papers on those things.
We attracted people from a wide variety of areas. Those were streams at the time. I was just so new to public health, I was trying to get into the science of it, because prior to working at Massey, I managed an infectious diseases laboratory. I was heavily involved in the clinical end of epidemiology, and in particular the natural history of the hepatitis B virus and the efficacy of the hepatitis B vaccine. I was really interested in the scientific end, and that's what attracted me to public health. Yeah.
Now, a lot of people aren't sure what public health actually means.
I think like health, it means different things to different people, and it's probably more important when you haven't got it. Or when there's a crisis, that's when you know public health becomes very important. We saw it in Havelock North with the failure of the water supply there.
Okay. And the Jardine. So it's not the direct sort of doctor-patient or hospital-patient relationship. It's the broader environment and people's broader behaviour in the community, or something like that. Would it be?
It is. You know, doctors have a role in, you know, doctors, as we see, you know, general practitioners have a role in public health. They do. They are responsible for some of the really important public health services, such as the delivery and recording of immunisations for children and right through the population. And they want to get involved in the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. And so that's really important. But public health is primarily the opportunity to prevent disease.
Okay.
It focuses on reducing the risk of disease spreading in the community, so often it's called population health. One of the themes of one of the public health conferences I went to was the art and science, and it is as much an art as it is a science, although often the focus is on the science of public health. The art is really important, and that's around the relationships public health practitioners have to foster in order to be effective in their job.
So things like if you want immunisation, then there's certain groups are very easy to reach and others are harder. So do you go for the low hanging fruit, or do you try and reach the at risk target populations?
Part of the wisdom in preventive medicine is to do your best to reduce risk. So sometimes population coverage isn't possible. So what you do is you identify your high-risk groups and you focus on them. I think it's probably clearest in screening for cancers. You know, cervical cancer, you look at women. And if we had a screening program for prostate cancer, we'd concentrate on men. You know, that's a very sensible way of looking. Yeah. But it gets a bit more technical after that, because if you look at breast cancer, the people most likely to be affected by breast cancer are men, but the incidence of breast cancer in men is so low that it's very difficult to screen. So we rely on primary health care and on men understanding what changes in their bodies to look at early intervention.
So when you said that, you mean that if men get breast cancer, it's more serious than if women get breast cancer?
It can be.
But they're far less likely to get it, would you
say?
Yeah.
So it's a risk-based approach, you know, which is why we've established a breast screen. You know, Jenny Shipley, I think, opened the first breast screening mobile one in Martin.
One of the arguments against prostate screening for many years was they were saying, well, the screening's not too clear, so there could be all sorts of false positives and false negatives, and we don't have an effective treatment anyway, so there's no point screening. I think the attitude's changed a bit.
Well, another way to put that, and I think probably one that people might understand better, is that once there is a risk of cancer, the practitioner is obliged to treat. So that once you suspect that a person has cancer, you're ethically obliged to offer them treatment. With prostate cancer, an often misused screening tool is PSA. It's a prostate.
That's the initial indicative test, isn't it?
It's not. It was actually devised to monitor the treatment of prostate cancer.
Okay,
so it monitors the presence of prostate cancer. It doesn't necessarily indicate its genesis or the direction which it is going. And you need a urologist and an oncologist to understand that.
But it's what's used to identify if someone should be looked into further.
If a person has a high PSA test, certainly look further. But it varies a lot. And unfortunately, you need other confirmatory examination to determine whether prostate cancer exists. And then after that, it's family history and also the age of the person. Many men have prostate disease when they die, but it's never affected them in their lives.
Yeah, you die with it rather than of it, but that's because some is rapidly moving and others are.
But one
argument would be that in, say, breast cancer, there'd been enough research done to be able to screen effectively and to treat, whereas prostate cancer, they hadn't looked into it enough to have the approaches that were effective. So to say we don't really have the effective approaches, so we won't do it, it's a sort of circular argument.
But, well, it also depends on advocacy, and perhaps advocacy in terms of establishing a screening program for men to diagnose prostate cancer hasn't been as effective as breast cancer and or cervical cancer.
Certainly not as successful.
But look, cervical cancer, public health, you know, cervical cancer, and mihi te kiri Ellen and her diagnosis, and I wish her every success with her treatment. But
now that's, it was a current minister in the government.
Kiri Ellen has taken sick leave to undergo treatment for cervical cancer. Until recently, she was the Minister for Emergency.
Things like COVID, I think she was announcing various changes.
And she's a very capable person from the Bay of Plenty, and that's where I'm from. You know, we produce the odd jewel, but back to the matter in hand. Cervical cancer has been one where the pathology of cervical cancer was better understood. We were taking swabs and then colposcopy samples if required, meant the disease could be managed and mortality rates decreased. And then once we understood the role of the human papillomavirus, we were then able to look at producing a vaccine, and the vaccines have gotten better and better. Mm. And it's almost to the stage now, and with careful monitoring, we may be able to stop screening and just monitor for the presence of antigens or the presence of a history of vaccination against the human papillomavirus.
Okay.
Because it seems to be
that effective.
Yeah. However, what happens is that you still have a residual population for whom the vaccine doesn't work, and you've got to find some way of diagnosing them early enough. So. Mm. We won't know for some time whether we can actually afford to stop taking swabs, and self-swabbing may be a suitable alternative to the current manner in which swabs are taken.
Yeah.
And perhaps just a simple blood test to look for the presence of the vaccine, or a noted vaccine, a history of vaccination, may be sufficient. And it may be as simple as the routine vaccinations that are given at the moment for measles, rubella, and things like that, if you need to, like with polio, you get a booster. So that's the success of public health. You know, the science has been used to understand the disease and in a manner that medicine can understand and intervene.
Yeah.
And then as the science and knowledge has progressed and population-based interventions like vaccines have been introduced, medicine has had necessarily a lesser role, simply because there's less demand for the intrusive treatments that often follow a diagnosis of cancer, in this particular time, cervical cancer.
Yeah.
So we deal with one thing, but we're still left with the residual public health challenges of making sure that people get vaccinated, and monitoring the success of that vaccination program, and making sure that that's linked to the cancer register.
And the more effective you are, the more people get resistant to the vaccines because they think they aren't important anymore because the diseases aren't a problem.
Oh, that's another story. that is a real challenge, but not only to public health. I think to most, I think interventions where if you have a good uptake in the population, the risk and managing the downside of that risk is much easier because you're dealing with fewer people. A good example is homelessness. You know, if you can invest in housing, you have fewer people likely to be homeless. But if you don't invest in it, you could end up in a situation where you have a great demand for housing and an inability to provide it.
Yeah.
So people are homeless, and that's a huge, huge public health challenge.
Yeah, and you're actually broadening it out, because public health is a lot more than just trying to pick up diseases early and so on. Because, in fact, weren't they saying one of the major advances in health and increasing life expectancy were things like the sanitation measures and lifestyle measures? In fact, a lot of effort going into, say, stopping smoking because of the health. So changing behaviours and the way we organise ourselves as a society to improve health.
We do, but whether we change behaviours or whether we follow the trend as public health practitioners and take credit for the change, I actually think it's the latter more than the former.
So all this stopping smoking campaigns and employees working on these things, they're just taking credit for what would have happened anyway.
Well, they have an effect, but I think we probably give ourselves as public health practitioners more credit than we deserve. Mm. Because, you know, like with COVID-19, as much as there was leadership from the Prime Minister down, it took a whole population, you know, I shouldn't say so-called, you know, the team of 5 million stepped up.
I always suspected New Zealand's response, the compliance that you got in New Zealand, would that be partly because of our long experience with the biosecurity and threats that way, where the idea is you find there's a fruit fly come into the country and you spray massive areas around the airports and docks and so on and set traps everywhere. So the idea is sort of stamp on things very early and spend a lot of money just to stop it spreading. Part of our culture that maybe helped us understand this one?
Well, we used to spray everything that sat on an aeroplane at one stage.
Yes.
And we stopped doing that and then we've had to, you know, treat a wider area. I'm not sure the reason for stopping it other than frequent flies being a bit annoyed about getting sprayed frequently.
I remember that. Land in Auckland Airport, they walk down spraying, walk down the cabin spraying everybody.
So, our approach is to, you know, controlling the introduction of diseases and pests, you know, has changed and we've gone through.
But we understand the importance of it, whereas... So I'm just thinking of contacts I know in or from the UK where things have already spread everywhere. There aren't things they're trying to exclude because they've already got in. Mm. And so their understanding of what we're doing, I think what a massive overreaction. I think they can see in hindsight that what we did was probably the right way to go.
I think what we did was successful. I'm not sure if it would have worked in the UK. Simply because we are 16 hours flight away and at least one flight from Australia, 13-hour flight from the Middle East, and probably 12 hours from Singapore or Hong
Which
Kong.
Which means what? We've got ports and airports as points of entry. The UK has ports and airports as points of entry.
Yeah, we do. But I think the ability to screen and... the distance travel means that we have a little bit more warning than they have in the UK the arrival and spread of disease. I think also that communication, and if we just look at COVID-19, and I'm not sure if we understand why we were successful, but I think it's healthy to speculate. I think because the more discussion we have about this, the better we'll eventually come to a common understanding of what is, and it's a difficult experiment to repeat. However, the fear in January and February amongst the health professionals I knew, because they had colleagues working overseas, or some of them had just returned from Europe, was that there was a disaster about to arrive in New Zealand, and if we didn't do our best to stop it, you know, we would be overwhelmed as they were in Italy. And so every effort was made, and I think credit to the Director General of Health, who I think had worked at the World Health Organization, had managed a DHB, had been a chief executive of a DHB here in New Zealand, so he understood how the health system worked. But his primary medical specialty was a public health medicine specialist, so he understood intuitively the science behind it.
Yeah.
And I think his manner meant that he could give advice without panicking people, but give it in a manner that they could process and act on. Part of the strategy, you know, part of the thing you learn and the things that we are taught is, you know, basically how to handle the media and how to process information for the media, because although the media like headlines to sell newspapers, you've got to understand what sits behind that. Yeah. So that the messages can...
the idea was a very simple, clear message.
Yeah.
But the New Zealand success was also largely due to the very high level of compliance.
Oh, yes.
Which that's where things have fallen down in many of the, European countries, maybe Americas as well.
We learnt from H1N1 and the bird flu. The bird flu is an analogous to what we've got now. the main control mechanisms in North America and Canada who suffered badly from bird flu was lack of social distancing and fomites. And so they spent... Fomites are infection from a contaminated surface.
Oh, okay.
So the fomites are the things that sit on surfaces that can infect you.
It's these invisible mites.
It's miasma theory gone rogue.
Yeah. I don't know if it was Star Trek or something, other TV thing where someone was trying to say, you know, there's these germs, you can catch disease from germs. So someone said, you mean there's these minute invisible things that we can't see that are trying to kill us? Yes, that's right.
Well, yeah, no, there are real world examples of these. Hepatitis B, when it was first characterised, was taken from the tissue of an Aboriginal man who died of liver failure. He was a man from Western Australia, which is what was called the Australian antigen. Mm-hmm. And Burick Blumberg, who characterised it, shared a Nobel Prize for medicine with it. Mm-hmm. It was not well understood, and it was often called serum hepatitis simply because it was mostly transmitted through by transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
But once the antigen test was devised and used to detect the presence of the disease, they found that there were two groups of people with the disease. Those were people who got ill and those people who didn't. Mm-hmm. And those people who didn't tended to be infected with the virus for a long period of time. And then they started looking at the transmission of the disease. So Stephen Hadler from CDC studied the transmission of hepatitis B in gay men and set up serial serum collections from gay men and discovered that the disease was largely spread as an STD in gay men. Those same serum samples were then retested when the AIDS epidemic began. And they understood how HIV was being spread in the gay population.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's the advantage of, the science end of public health, is that we can, once we have a way of quantifying something, we can then start to measure it and with time understand how it is spread, because epidemiology is basically how diseases move in populations and understanding that. But going back to hepatitis B, the little of it was not well understood, it was treated as, because it was so frequent in the northern part of New Zealand, down from Taupo up, it was in rural areas, it was treated as an occupational risk that eventually you'd get hepatitis B, you'd have a few weeks off, you'd feel sick as a dog, but you'd get over it.
Normally it is just a short-term illness, you mean, or it's active for a while and then it's latent and can flare up? Or
no, if you get infected as in your late teenage years or as an adult, it's usually an acute version and you become ill because your body, it infects your liver and it reproduces in your liver. And your immune response to hepatitis B is to kill the cells that are infected with the virus, and so what happens is your immune system attacks your liver, and that causes the illness because your liver functions compromised and you become jaundiced. And eventually you recover. Some people die. However, if you're very young when you're infected or you're immune compromised, an older person, the infection becomes a grumbling infection that your body doesn't respond to. The virus sits and replicates in your liver. As a young person, because you've got a very active liver, you can produce a huge amount of virus. So you can spread the disease very, very quickly, and it's done through crossing the skin barrier, basically. It can be transmitted as an STD. That's how it efficiently spread in communities. That was real, and therefore it's very important to prevent the infection of babies. So the very first vaccination programs were to women who were identified as hepatitis B carriers about to deliver a baby. So what they would do was they would give the baby immunoglobulin and then the vaccine. Prior to the delivery of the vaccine, the immunoglobulin, which is antibodies taken from the blood of a person that had hepatitis B was all that you could do to protect somebody. You could so give them
build some resistance from that.
Yeah. It was a temporary bolus of protection that eventually wore off. The vaccine taught your body how to make the antibodies. And so we were very, very interested. So when I joined the Hepatitis Research Unit in 1988, it was to evaluate the second part of the population program, which was then to vaccinate children under five. We had an effective vaccine, and we had a way of delivering it, which was through the Plunkett nurses. And so every child under five was offered the vaccine, and my job was to evaluate that program with the Hepatitis Unit. It was very effective. And then as the vaccine, the unfortunate thing about the hepatitis B vaccine was that it was produced from the plasma, it was refined plasma from people who had hepatitis B. And so it went through several stages of purification and sterilisation to remove any risk of infection. And then the then it was turned into, the plasma was then turned into a vaccine and delivered. It was very expensive because of the process, but part of the expense was that only one manufacturer in the world made it at the time. But the French then produced a reasonable hepatitis B vaccine. But with genetic engineering, the recombinant vaccines came along, and so they spliced the genome into, part of the genome into Brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces japonica, and out of that produced the viral antibodies, antigens, that could be used to produce a vaccine.
And we can see lots of developments along those lines.
The COVID vaccine is just another application of science.
Now, I seem to recall, given that so much funding moved to the idea of you've got to show what you're achieving, public health always seemed to come up as the poor partner in that, didn't it? Because it's not easy to identify in the short term the benefits of the public health activities.
Well, if I wasn't cynical, I would say that's why we're getting a public health body now that will be commissioning alongside the Health New Zealand and the Māori Commissioning Agency. And then it's largely on the success. So I think you're right. I think it wasn't a lack of efficacy. I think that because we've done a good job for so long, that public health tended to get overlooked. And in some ways, I think politicians were a bit suspicious of it because they thought we were a crying wolf, when in actual fact, we were saying that if we're not careful, these diseases could arrive. You know, we've managed to keep dengue out, and that's mainly because climate change meant that the mosquitoes that carry, or the vectors that carry these diseases, can't live in New Zealand at the moment. But there will be a time when they will, if climate change heads the way it's anticipated. You know, we will have to deal with dengue, we will have to deal with malaria if we get the malaria mosquito established here. So our borders are really important, and I think they can take some of the credit for controlling and limiting the spread of COVID-19 into New Zealand. But I think, given that it did arrive and that we did have hotspots in New Zealand, the population response to that was magnificent. You know, in spite of the public health message we had in place, which were less than perfect and are still improving.
They were designed for a different sort of, was it a flu sort of thing they thought of with the public health structure, how to respond?
I think the public health, the contact tracing was around the old infectious diseases like polio, the newer ones like measles, all vaccine preventable, all very, very infectious, but required a local approach, which is why they were ideally focused in local public health units. However, with the mobility of people now, coupled with a highly infectious disease that could be spread by aerosols or close contact, and we needed to a way of collaborating between these centres, which we'd never really required before, at a scale that would challenge, you know, any system. You know, the Australians, I think, thought they had a pretty good contact tracing system, and it proved magnificent during the Sydney Olympics, but it's seriously wanting now.
Yeah.
And it is simply the disease and our greater mobility.
But globally, there'll be major changes given our experience with COVID-19, presumably.
I think we'll go back to the strategies that were used for polio, for managing polio, and diseases like that, where we will have to audit very carefully our monitoring of the disease, our delivery of the vaccine, and the record of vaccination, so that we know who's protected.
And you think, say, for international travel, there'd be the same sort of screening as we have for now for explosives and weapons and so on? Are there going to be health-type temperature screenings and so on?
Maybe. That can be incorporated. You know, the temperature monitoring is easy enough, but I think the documentation of vaccination. Look, we had to, in the old days, we used to have to carry a Ministry of Health record about our immunisation, especially if you're going to.
Things like smallpox and things
Asia,
like that.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? Those
sorts of
things.
So, I think it's just a step back into that.
Another broad area of public health, though, is the lifestyle issues, like we've talked about. There's smoking, there's alcohol consumption, there's diet causing obesity and diabetes and so on, which are, some people are saying there's going to be major problems with diabetes in the future. Is that slightly different from the infectious disease sort of problems?
It isn't. The modelling is the same, but the time frames and
prevention will be different because it's people changing their behaviour, presumably.
Yeah, but in many ways, you know, I think you could almost say vaccination is a lifestyle choice as well. You know, it's about how we exercise our autonomy and how, you know, the collective efforts of society support that. You know, if you hopped on a bus or hopped on an aeroplane without a mask, now people look down and people would frown upon you, okay? And it's our tolerance for unsafe behaviour.
So what about tolerance for different sorts of foods and preservatives and the amount of sugar and fat and salt in the is that the individual choice, or is it the producers and advertisers and government regulation?
Well, I think there are many parts to that machine. I think that, you know, the black box that deals with that will have to address not only changing people's behaviours, but their behaviours in context, how they behave when they shop, how they behave when they prepare food, how they behave when they eat. And it's all those choices. And you want to remember that having a meal for most people, but not everyone, is a social thing. Yeah. Especially in your formative years, you know, hopefully people still eat at a table, will eat together anyway.
No, they're watching TV.
Yeah. No. I know.
Or on the computer.
I'm bad
it's
at that too.
It's changing a lot.
But that's the opportunity. If people's ways of socialising around food are changing, I think we've got to look at different strategies for doing that, because the real risk, and I think COVID-19 is, I think, brought that back to the, you know, right to the formative attention of the population, is that if we don't avoid these things, our health system fails, and people die unnecessarily of not only of COVID-19 in this case, but of other things that our health system could have been treating instead. So in many ways, public health protects the health system from the unintended consequences of the risks we face every day, you know, from the not wearing a seatbelt through to poor hand hygiene in terms of COVID-19.
Now, I suppose the conflict is how far you go in sort of giving people individual freedom and responsibility, and how far you try to protect them from this.
Well, I think that you do, but it's also a matter of agency. You know, if you haven't got hand sanitizer, how can you expect to practice good hand hygiene? If the airlines didn't supply masks, how many people would bring their own? So, you know, it is a matter of autonomy, and I think unless there's actually good regulation around that, I'm not talking about what the government says, but how people actually respond to people not, you know, literally pulling their own weight. You know, I think we've got to be, you know, we've got to, in many ways, and I think that's one of the things that is part of New Zealand culture, is a certain willingness to comply. It's not entirely. We're not entirely compliant population, but
no.
Can I just ask? Yeah. You talked about the cancer register.
Yeah.
There was a polio register,
yeah,
I assume.
Yeah.
Will there be a COVID-19 register?
But that's probably a good idea because, you know, we have a way of doing that, and I think the benefit would be is that, like with the post-polio syndrome that's now being seen now, and that long COVID is something that we probably need to understand. I think until we have a great deal of confidence in the intersection between primary and secondary healthcare in terms of that sharing of information, a standalone register is probably quite useful. Who would look after that? I don't know. But, you know, the Breast Cancer Foundation has two cancer registers. I think they've amalgamated them. Our cancer register, you know, the National Cancer Register, is limited in what it can do. It's largely for registering cancers. It's not actually used for treatment, whereas I think a COVID-19 register would be one about looking after those people with COVID, with long COVID, because it could be as serious as polio.
Yeah. And these are all countered by all the privacy issues as to how much information is available and shared.
The notion of privacy is one where at the moment there is general trust for the health bubble.
If you know, as long as that's kept separate.
And I think that still stands, although the research that we did is more than 10 years old.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.